Hello, and welcome, or welcome back, to International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. I'm Adam 5, and thank you for listening. This is episode 15. It's going to be another listener-directed episode. As I've said in earlier podcasts, or at least in the very first one, I've wanted this whole series to at least be influenced, if not steered, by listener feedback. And speaking of listener feedback, since we are at the very top of the show, I'm going to get right to that. Now, here's one that I missed from episode 13. It was left as a comment on the podcast pickle setup that they have over there. I practically never go to Podcast Pickle for any particular reason other than to check to see that my feed is still working. The RSS feed. But of course, I did want to make the show available there for anyone that made extensive use of Podcast Pickle to get their podcast downloads. But at any rate, this one is from Digger, and it's about episode 13. Another great show. Of course, Digger and Poots loved the higher-pitched voice, easier to relate to, and it does speed up the listening experience, which everyone loves. If you are using Audacity or an audio editor, you will be able to change the tempo without raising your pitch. Nevertheless, it was cool, and the rant was very informative. We all need to hear it, and loved that you had helpful suggestions, URLs to go to. Loved your shorts. Do you think you could come up with a short for a Digger story? Had to ask. And that's what you get when you're good at something. Don't you know it? Keep up the great work. You are up for a nomination for Podcast Peer Awards, which you can join after 3 months of podcasting. Pod on, Patter. That would be from Digger Poots and Patter of Digger Story. And I'm sorry I missed that last episode. It should have been read almost immediately. And we have, to continue listener feedback, we have from Sarah of Does My Geek Look Big In This? And this is feedback for episode 8. Now, before I read this one from Sarah, I should say that it's a spoiler alert. For those that watch Buffy, you should stick your fingers in your ears right now and go la 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 for about, I guess, a minute, and then you won't hear the letter and you can continue listening to the podcast. But here's the spoiler alert. She reveals something in this letter that you maybe not want to know if you watch Buffy and haven't seen it yet. And she writes,
Hi, Adam 5. Listened to episode 8 the other day and just had to email you with my most hated fictional character. It's Joyce Summers from Buffy. A fast, painless death was too good for her. Thanks for this episode. It really made me laugh. Sarah.
All right, then. I'm forced to agree with you. I think that it would be too good. I think that a more suitable punishment for that fictional character, just in case anyone has taken their fingers out of their ears, I think a suitable punishment for that character would be to have her eyes propped open with toothpicks and be forced to sit in the audience and watch the Irvington High School production of Brigadoon from 1972 over and over and over again throughout eternity. I seriously, seriously doubt anyone that's listening to this or ever will listen to this remembers or saw the Irvington High School musical production of Brigadoon that was put on stage in 1972. And if they did, I congratulate you for having survived it. Another listener feedback, this from Mr. T, and it relates directly to episode 14, which he is unwittingly instrumental in having directed the course it took, but at any rate, from Mr. T.
Horace Wright, not Herennis. Laugh out loud.
I'm being kind here, Mr. T. I'll move on. When I wrote my last mail
to you, I couldn't remember the name of the annoying chipmunks. Alvin. Alvin was the character. And you're right, Chip and Dale are great characters.
I think he meant to say all along, well, obviously, what he's writing here is he meant to say all along that Alvin was what it sounded like. And you know what? I can relate to what he was saying. And I have to, referring back to Digger's email about the higher-pitched voice being easier to relate to, well, it certainly would be, of course, for Digger and Poots. And if you don't understand that reference, then speed on over to Digger's story and listen to those episodes. You'd understand. No, they're not all done precisely the way I did mine, obviously not. They're it's a thoroughly different show, but it's certainly worth listening to. At any rate, I can understand Digger's point of view. I know why I played the episode at high speed, or rather in that particular tone, that pitch, and I've already talked about why. But I certainly understand Mr. T, and I certainly understand an aversion to listening to Alvin for 50 minutes, because I hate Alvin and the Chipmunks, owing to a very special reason, and that is mall music. About 1,000 years ago, just out of high school, when I used to work retail at a bookstore in a mall, they would play Christmas music. And one of the songs that they repeated over and over and over again was the Chipmunk Christmas album, Christmas Don't Be Late. I won't even go into it, but yes, it still makes my eye twitch to this very day. Let me get back to Mr. T's letter. I think maybe I should start it from the beginning.
When I wrote my last mail to you, I couldn't remember the name of the annoying chipmunks. Alvin. Alvin was the character. And you're right, Chip and Dale are great characters. But the chipmunks are chipettes. You get my point. Man, you are right. Taking the voice acting over the top really helps you loosen up. It even inspired me to make an end credit for Dragon's Landing. I kind of hope they don't play it, but it was fun. Great show, Annam. Here's a topic to take up. Can MMORPGs ruin lives? Or, on the other hand, can they save lives? Is life a game? I'm at work now. I'm going to try to start this topic of when I get home, but in case I don't, well, it's an interesting topic. I play World of Warcraft, so I can see it being addictive. Hear you around, Thomas.
Sorry it took so long to get to that, the end of that letter there. That topic, massive multiplayer online role-playing games, that will be the topic, or at least it'll be central to the next podcast after this one. And we'll look at all different aspects of that. I had planned for a while on doing something connected with that, because of course it's certainly going to be relevant to most people that are listening to shows like this or podcasts in general, because let's face it, it means that you are far more likely to be computer connected, you're far more likely to be computer literate, and you're far more likely to be involved with or have at least played one time or another an MMORPG. But this podcast will not be about that. This podcast, number 15, is going to be about a request that was made from the Digger Story podcast. Now, if you haven't listened to Digger's Story, its absolute goal, its purpose, at least so far as I can interpret it, its purpose is to achieve peace, not to promote peace, not to raise awareness of peace efforts, but to achieve peace, to find out how to do it, to find out what it is. Not necessarily in that order. Well, one of the things, just working toward that road, working toward that goal, one of the things that Digger, Poots, and Patter began doing was to get definitions of peace from friends, relatives, associates, podcasters, whoever, recorded definitions of peace, and what it is that was being done to accomplish it. In other words, the question asked specifically of me, Annam 5, was, how do you define peace? What does peace mean to you? And what are you doing to achieve it? And it seemed pretty straightforward. And like I said in episode 1 of International Detective Dragons from Outer Space, sometimes the easiest questions are the hardest. And I think with that, before I get rolling in earnest with episode 15, it's time for a small break. Back in a bit. You know, all I ever really wanted, all I want now, and all I ever really wanted ever since I was a little kid, is total omnipotence. Is that too much to ask? I think one of the reasons I had such a hard time coming up with a simple 1 minute, 2 minute, or even 3 minute answer to those two questions posed from the Digger Story podcast. What is peace? What does peace mean to you? What is your definition of peace? and what are you doing to help bring it about? One of the main reasons that I found it so difficult was because, and this is going to disappoint, I think, was because I'm not really sure it's possible. I'm not really sure. I'm not convinced that it's possible. It's disappointing to me. It's extremely disappointing, upsetting, and frustrating to me, just as it is to most other people, I assume. But I just don't truly believe that it can be accomplished, that worldwide zero war can be accomplished. But I'll give a definition. I'll give you my definition of peace anyway. I don't want this to sound like a downer here, but we'll mix it up. We'll mix it up with the pluses and minuses, because that's pretty much what episode 15 is going to be about. It's going to be about the human being. The human being is a coin with two sides that has a good face on one side and a bad face on the other. The human being is a split creature. Is a tragic hero or tragic heroine, if you will, a being capable of incredible things with a tragic flaw built in. But I'm not going to get too deep into that yet. I've got a few things to say before that. The first one, of course, as usual, I take forever and a day to get to the point, but I'll start with the definition. Peace is a world, this is Anam Phi's definition of peace. Peace is a world where human beings no longer act like they're humans. Peace is a world where humanity, as a whole, has carried out what their best and brightest philosophies have told them to, and transcended their bodies, where they've become more than the sum of their parts. Peace is a world where a good reason for doing something actually overpowers the cost of doing it, where money is actually worth less than human life. Peace is a world where human beings recognize the need to exert energy and endure pain in order to keep living, but declare it a universal crime for small groups or individuals to avoid that exertion and pain by using their fellow human beings as slaves and livestock. Peace is a world where the most important thing every kid everywhere all over the earth, the most important thing every kid can worry about is when the next PlayStation is going to come out and whether they can convince their parents to buy them one. Peace is a world where people cannot be emotionally manipulated by liars. In other words, peace is a world where humans no longer act like they're humans. Now, the next thing I have to say before I actually just go off and contradict myself, because that's what I'm about to do, I'm going to make an emotional statement here. And I'm going to pour contempt on just the act of talking about this the way I'm about to. Because I can't answer it. What are you doing to bring peace about? I don't know what to do. I really don't. I don't know what would be effective. And I don't know how to answer that. And the saddest effort about this particular podcast is going to be that all I can do is talk about it and philosophize about it and go into all these shallow, heady theories about the duality of man. And even as I was writing out my definition of peace, all I kept getting in my head was this vision. And you know what? It's not fact. It's not straight out of a specific news story, but it was a vision in my head of a little girl that had her foot blown off and half her clothes burned away, crying her eyes out, of course, leaning against a pile of rubble, with the image of her mother having been blown through a window, freshly implanted in her brain. Because there's war going on, because it's war. And what do you say? What can you say? If you place yourself right there in front of that child, assuming that you know her language fluently, which you probably don't, I certainly don't, what would I say? I'm going to spend the next, 45 minutes to half an hour going into philosophy. I'm going to sit here in the comfort of my easy chair, and I'm going to wax eloquent on the state of man and the duality of the human being, but I can't replace her foot, I can't bring her mother back to life, and I can't give her some decent clothes to wear and the assurance that she's going to grow up with any kind of a life. when you put yourself right there, you know, when it's not out on the other side of the world, because I think this is half the problem, when it's not on the other side of the world and you just bring the vision of that and the injustice of that into your head and know that it's real. Distance, for some bizarre, mad reason, and we'll go into madness too, for some mad reason, turns it into something unreal, turns it into a concept to be discussed. It's not a concept to be discussed, it's an unjust reality taking place right now. And the sad part, the truly depressing part, is that it just has always frickin' been like this. Peace on earth, peace all over the world. How is it that the majority of human beings want it? Unless I'm wrong, am I wrong? Is it really the vast majority of human beings that enjoy going to war and blowing things up and killing people and running around and burning down cities and poisoning the air and the water and whatever? Just spreading total misery, essentially? Does everybody want that? I really don't think so. Has everybody always wanted that? I don't think so. I don't know how many guys, you know, either sitting, whether they were sitting on a farm in their apartment or in their own house, or whether they were a son, husband, brother, how many women throughout history, I don't know how many of them heard the news that war was imminent and that they were either about to invade or they were about to be invaded and just broke out into dance, you know. So how is it that if the majority of human beings want peace, how is it that the whole of the species hasn't had peace since the first human being started breathing? There's something wrong. There is something basically wrong. This episode will go into art a lot. And when I say art, I mean musicals, motion pictures. I'm not talking about cave paintings or Cézanne or Renoir or Monet, Manet. I'm talking about contemporary art. The oldest thing I can think of to go into probably would be Don Juan in Hell. But I probably won't refer to that much. Let's go more recent. Let's go to 2001 A Space Odyssey. Right at the top, very beginning. You got that ape. Now this, of course, is calling it alien intervention. Starting with the topic of human evolution. Forget the part that there's an obelisk standing nearby. Forget the part that supposedly this obelisk was manipulating the mental energies or intelligence of the apes that were hiding in the night. The most eloquent evolutionary statement made in cinema is the tossing of that big bone. Am I being really obscure? I think so. Let me lay this out for somebody that hasn't seen 2001 A Space Odyssey. At the very beginning of the motion picture, it focuses on the primates that were to become the ancestors of humanity. They're barely surviving. They're hiding in caves and trees in the night. They're subject to whatever wild animal can catch up with one of them. And they're in competition for a watering hole with another group of primates on the other side of the hill. The obelisk shows up. There is one particular ape in the book, I believe, the character name is Moonwatcher, who somehow starts to get more dexterous, somehow starts to reason things out a little bit more, picks up a bone, a large, heavy thigh bone of a dead animal, and discovers that if he swings it, it will break things. If he holds it and swings it like a tool, swings it as a club, it will break things. And so he swings it, he kills some of the nearby animals that previously they weren't able to either weren't able to trap, catch, kill, or catch up with, or were too big for them, and they start eating well. Their competition with the group of primates on the other side of the hill becomes no longer a competition because, well, Moonwatcher's group all have big bones that they can swing. And they swing them, and they hit the other apes, and they kill the other apes, and they now control the watering hole. And there's Moonwatcher, screaming, pounding his chest, flings that bone up into the air, and the camera follows it as it's spinning. And in one shot, one clip, the bone turns into, I believe, a satellite. One of the most memorable, eloquent, temporal transitions in cinema. I think it's in textbooks. If it isn't, it ought to be. So what is that telling us? Why did I go off on that? Well, part of what makes us human beings part of what brought us to where we are today is what allowed us to survive to evolve intelligence in the first place. There's our first paradox. We expect ourselves, or at least the part of us that aspires to something greater than what we are, the part of us that has an imagined ideal, the part of us that sees a spiritual goal that transcends our animal selves, has tried for several thousand years to steer society in the direction of benevolent, humane, and peaceful practices. Essentially saying, you are a spiritual being, you are an angelic being, but you are placed in an animal body. Your animal body feels fear, feels pain, feels hunger, is aware that it's going to die, and must struggle not only against its own decay, but against an environment that wants to kill it. Your spiritual being is expected to behave within this body in an angelic fashion. Your spiritual being trapped in an animal body, and you are expected to behave in an angelic fashion. Or if not in an angelic fashion, then in a fashion you have no reason to behave like. You're expected to behave in a way that everything that's kept you alive to this point has taught you is not the thing to do. All we've seen, all I've seen, in the headlines, and in at least the history of the past 100 years, has been nationalism rampant. Our country, right or wrong, and that's not just the United States, it's whatever country is crowing the loudest, depending on who's got the microphones pointing in which direction. Nationalism, borders, our country won't put up with this, our group won't put up with this. You people over there haven't got the right to do that to us because we are, etc. Those people over there are worth less than we are. We're the United States, damn it. We're Great Britain, damn it. We're Russia, damn it. We're China, damn it. We're Korea, damn it. We're North Korea, damn it. We're Iraq. We're Iran. You have no right. All borders, the spiritual aspect that would strive for peace, that would, and it's a spiritual aspect that exists in all of us. The problem is it keeps getting separated. The separation of church and state, never mind church, the separation of spiritualism, conscience, morality from politics, that separation pretty much exists only on paper. So that spiritual aspect of every human being in every country that wants to take that little girl off the pile of rubble, get her the hell out of there, get her medical treatment, fix her leg, give her a prosthetic foot, whatever, put clean clothes on her and put her in a foster home or take care of themselves, because they just, if they were standing right there, couldn't stand to see it. That's real. And the socio-political jargon, the economic mandates, the political hype that's actually causing the firebombing or the precision bombing or the suicide bombing to go on, that creates the situation that you look at when you're standing there, all of that is unreal. And yet it's causing destruction. The hatred that fuels that, that's real. So I suppose by extension, the bombs aren't dropping as a result of fantasies. The bombs are dropping as a result of hatreds. So why do I think it isn't possible to bring about peace worldwide? I don't know. Let's go back to art again, contemporary art. The Princess Bride. One of the most memorable lines for me from The Princess Bride is when the dread pirate Roberts, i.e. Wesley, turns to the princess and says, "Life is pain, Highness. Anyone that tells you different is selling something." Well, yeah, life is pain. Or keeping yourself alive requires a certain amount of pain. For some, it's simply having to get up when the alarm goes off, enduring a commute, and putting in a 40-hour week at a place that they can't stand, or that they can stand, but just wouldn't particularly like to be there if they were rich enough to be someplace else, or nowhere at all, just home sleeping. That's not much pain, but it's still a certain amount of sacrifice in order to get by, in order to keep living. For other people, it's plowing the soil and keeping livestock. For other people, it's working in a factory in a regime where they have to work for 18 hours a day or 12 hours a day for 50 cents a week or whatever they pay them. Life is the avoidance of pain. So when that stops, war might not stop, but it would be a good beginning. If we were no longer human beings that could suffer pain or had to worry about keeping ourselves alive because of all the animal needs that we're left with, if that were no longer the case, maybe there'd be less war. I'm not sure about that. The other thing to think about is the way we look at it. What is it that really makes us wince, really makes us shut our eyes tight and shake our heads and just be ashamed to be human, or be ashamed that we've come so far, or at least existed so long and still haven't managed to stop this? That it's the year 2006 and we're still drawing lines in the dirt and calling ourselves us and calling them. That we're still the large group of primates on this side of the hill that don't trust or can't get along with, coincide with, or share with the large group of primates on the other side of the hill because of the watering hole between us. Is it death from war that drives us crazy? Is it the death itself that so many people are killed because of war? I don't believe that's the case. It's not death by itself. It's the cause of death. It's the fact. I mean, the fact is more people die from accidents and natural disasters than from all the wars put together. I mean, that's a simple fact. 1.2 million people died from auto accidents last year all over the world. That recent Asian tsunami, 250,000 people died. More people died from malaria last year than from all the AIDS victims over the past 15 years. Put them all together. More people died from malaria last year than that. And while we're certainly not, you know, dancing for joy over that, we're not particularly happy, that doesn't seem to drive us as nuts as death from war. Because it's death by injustice. It's death by bad human intent. Evil death that can be avoided by choosing not to inflict it. That's what drives us nuts. That's why you hear such an outcry for peace. It's basically saying we've got enough problems. The earth itself has been trying to kill us since we got here. Our own stupidity kills more of us than war. So what do we need war for? What do we have to go out of our way to hunt each other and kill each other? We've supposedly evolved intelligence. We shouldn't be doing this. Supposedly we're smarter than that. I don't know what, you know, a lot of evidence points to the contrary, of course. I mean, you've got, at least in the United States, you've got people that would rather watch the murder trial of an ex-football player than pay any attention to a comet crashing into Jupiter. They had the opportunity to watch a comet crash into a planet in their solar system, something that no one in the history of humanity had ever seen before, and no one is likely to see again, and it came and went. And what was all over the television, what was the most important leading story, was the O.J. Simpson trial. And aside from that, you've got people that are setting towns on fire and overturning buses and having riots over the results of soccer games. Evil death that can be avoided by choosing not to inflict it. And that choice becomes more and more difficult to make depending on what's written on your slate and how much power you have within the system you're living in. Because we're all born with a blank slate. That's another little built-in tragic flaw of humanity. We're born not knowing squat. We are born not knowing what to do. No other creature. We're supposedly the most intelligent. Splendid. We're the most intelligent. No other creature on earth is born to grow up totally helpless. Even ants know what to do. Even ants are born, live, and die knowing precisely what it is they're supposed to do. This is why a little smirk forms on my face every time I hear, save the planet, save the planet. Planet's fine. Planet's gonna be fine. We're the ones in trouble. If every human being on Earth disappeared tomorrow, the animal kingdom would get along just swell. Now, that arrogant message that Don Juan in Hell had, where the world could be improved, where nature had evolved man in order to lead it and improve the Earth, that's one of the ones I really don't buy. I really don't buy that. Interesting concept, but no. If we were gone, the animals would be fine. Matter of fact, they'd be far better off. No, we're born with a blank slate. We are taught, we seem to be taught, all the same errors that we've repeated ever since we learned to write things down or remember things to say. Superstitions, hatreds, and ignorances are passed on, whether through oral traditions or written. Is there something built into the human animal, to the human nature, that eliminates the possibility of worldwide peace? And yet at the same time, we're galled by the fact that we don't have it. We're appalled by the fact that war continues. Now, currently, I think what's most galling to most of the people in the U.S. is the fact that we were flat-out lied to by those people we're told are our elected leaders. We were just flat-out lied to. We went and beat up a backward, poverty-ridden dictatorship for reasons that were blatantly economic, transparently economic. They had nothing to do with national security. And it just galls us even more that they're not even trying to hide their stupidity. They come up with new lies every minute as the bullshit continues. Split reasoning. The symbol that keeps coming, you know, aside from, as I continue this ramble, the symbol that keeps cropping up in front of my face is that of the yin and the yang, the classic yin-yang emblem, where you have the white area and the black area in dynamic revolution around a center, and in the center of each white area and black area, there's a dot of the opposite. We're split. We're split beings. We're bilateral mutations. Going back to art again. This time, a musical. A contemporary musical, if you want to measure time on a large scale. I was in this show, as a matter of fact. This is one of my theatrical nightmares. And I got into the show almost by accident. I was brought in by death. Name of the show is The Mystery of Edwin Drood. Do yourself a favor and pick up this soundtrack. If you have any musical taste at all and any appreciation of the English language, you will thoroughly enjoy this musical. But there is a part in the show called The Stage Manager. Not the main storyteller narrator type, but a kind of a subpart, a kind of a very minor role, but still it required a person on stage in certain places at certain times to say one or two lines here and there and carry out certain actions. Not a major role, but it was required, and it would be missed if that person weren't there. Well, this production was in progress. It had already started in one of the local theaters, one of the local semi-professional regional theaters. And the gentleman that was playing this minor role was an undertaker, and he was doing a removal from a house, and his apprentice or assistant or whatever had a stretcher with the corpse on it at one end, and he was at the other, and they were going down the stairs. He was on the lower end. His apprentice slipped, tripped, dropped, whatever, the stretcher, and the stretcher and the corpse fell on this fellow who was the stage manager in the show, breaking a rib as he went down the stairs. And they needed an immediate replacement. Next day. So I got hold of the soundtrack, listened to it, and they stuck me in a costume, and I saw the show for the first time from on stage, being directed by the other cast members to stand here, do this, do that, okay, just look that way. I only had about 5 or 6 lines to memorize at different points. That was not a problem. One of the best songs in the show, and one of the most eloquent lyrics in terms of describing what the human being in general is from a song called Both Sides of the Coin. And these are the lyrics.
I am not myself these days. For all I know, I might be you. There's more than room enough for two inside my mind. I am likewise in a haze of who I am from scene to scene. What's more, we two, we four, I mean, are in a bind. For is it I, or is it me? And if I'm him, and if I'm he, Each one of us might not agree on what's to do. And if I take opposing sides within myself, then who divides up what is right or wrong? I'll go along with you. Odds or evens, heads or tails, it's high or low, or black or white, or up or down, or left or right, or night or day. Nature seldom ever fails to most obligingly provide an undisclosed opposing side to one's dismay. There's shadows in this shining morn. If there's a rose, it bears a thorn. Your good is dead as soon as born, and yet we smile. But luck's division is perverse. It seems to work more in reverse. If things are better, they'll be worse in just a while.
Sounds a lot better when it's sung. It's a lot more fun when it's sung. It's two guys on stage that do that song. Where good is dead, as sin is born, and yet we smile. Amazing. That's humanity in a nutshell. I could be totally backwards about this whole thing. I know there's so much more that I don't know about people and about the rest of the world. Much more than I think I know as fact. I don't know if humanity is split down the middle as far as the violent and the non-violent, the sane and the insane, the ignorant and the intelligent. I do believe that people are split down the middle individually in terms of all those things, with dispositions, tendencies, and personalities that lean more in one direction or another. The animal self constantly fighting the spiritual self. Different points of view. That's reflected in art, too. I'll go back to another piece of art here, this time again, a musical. Not a very pleasant musical. It's got some gorgeous music in it. Certainly a very highly dramatic piece. You may have heard it or seen it because they televised this one. Sweeney Todd. Have you ever heard the soundtrack of Sweeney Todd? Opens up at the very beginning of the show with a sailor and Sweeney Todd himself. The sailor is one of those bright, optimistic, young, full of energy, bright horizon, good characters that would see the best in all people and put a shining face on almost everything he looks at. And he had rescued Sweeney Todd from a raft adrift in the sea after Sweeney Todd had escaped from, I guess, Botany Bay or some Australian penal colony and was making his way back to London. Sweeney Todd, of course, is the opposite. And he's got good reason to be the opposite. But you've got Anthony, which is the name of the bright young man, singing.
I have sailed the world, beheld its wonders from the Dardanelles to the mountains of Peru. But there's no place like London. I feel home again. I could hear the city bells ring. Whatever would I do? No, there's no place like London.
And his face is beaming as he's rowing along away from the ship. Sweeney Todd getting his goods together, scowling at him in the back, staring over the edge of the boat and looking out at London. And of course he has an entirely different view. This I thought also as lyrics were very eloquent for Sweeney Todd.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it, and its morals aren't worth what a pig can spit, and it goes by the name of London. At the top of the hole sit the privileged few, making mock of the vermin in the lower zoo, turning beauty into filth and greed. I, too, have sailed the world and seen its wonders, for the cruelty of men is as wondrous as Peru. But there's no place like London.
Same city, two men, two points of view. And Sweeney Todd's comment to Anthony is, you are young, life has been kind to you, you will learn. Built-in madness. There's something, I've often said this, and I still believe it. If I believe anything, I absolutely believe this. There is either something fundamentally missing from the human makeup. There is something fundamentally missing from the human brain, the human personality, whatever it is that it means to be a human being alive today, there's something missing or there's something present that doesn't belong there. There's a certain sense of abandonment that I feel is in operation here. It goes back to the fact that we are taught how to live by our parents and grandparents, one way or another. If we're brought up at all, we're taught what the world is and how we are to get along in it. Some people are taught better than others. But one way or another, the human animal has to be taught to become a human being. But the thing is, there are no absolutes, there are no truths that they're taught beyond what keeps the animal self alive. No absolute truths. No ironclad, positive, absolute, and here's how we prove it, reason for us being here. There's ancient wisdom, and ancient, you have to say, with a bit of a wink, because we're not all that ancient. But there's very old writings, there's very old philosophies carried down through the centuries that claim to know the truth, that base their truths on divine miracles that just don't seem to be happening today. For some reason, there was a cutoff point. For some reason, all these massive miracles that proved direct contact and the voice of God speaking to the people, all these miracles just suddenly seemed to stop at a certain point ages ago and aren't around for confirmation or affirmation of some universal truth. The only universal truth that every man, every human being on earth has is that if they don't eat, they'll die. If they stay out in the sun, they'll have a stroke. If they stay out in the freezing weather, they'll die of exposure. That they have to breathe, that they have to drink, and that after a certain amount of time, their body is going to kill them anyway. Everything beyond that is social speculation and spiritual speculation. Is there any wonder that we're insane? Is there any wonder that we're mad? The most fortunate among us, I think, are the ones that have the calmest souls that can at least sit back, observe, and not panic. The ones that don't let their immediate emotions rule their actions. I don't believe it makes them feel any less. I think it was Thoreau, though, that said it's a characteristic of wisdom not to do desperate things. We're certainly mad in the United States. In the U.S., in the U.S., it's perfectly acceptable to show on television the dramatization of a woman having her throat cut or a rotting corpse covered in maggots. That's perfectly fine. You can put that on primetime TV. But it's considered obscene to allow the showing of sex or even bare breasts. How juvenile and backward is that? It's more socially acceptable for your 11 or your 12-year-old to sit and watch some gangster mow down a crowd of his enemies with a machine gun, so long as it's in a movie and it's a dramatization and it's fiction. But if you portrayed the sexual act on television for them to watch or showed a nude body, that's obscene. That's filth that they shouldn't be watching. Which essentially means that American society has deemed itself capable of telling kids all about Santa Claus and his reindeer, but is incapable of telling kids what sex is. We're just not adult enough for that. We're not mature enough for that. We can certainly have kids, but we're not mature enough to bring them up in any rational way. We don't want them to know about sex before puberty. Is it because we shun the animal half? Like Spock in Amok Time, we're ashamed of the uncontrollable responses. We don't want to admit sexual stimuli during and after puberty invades and overpowers the intellect. We don't want to face that. We might as well be ashamed of eating and drinking or falling asleep. Split down the middle, a duality, a weird, tragic, internal flaw in our logic. If you're a politician of any rank in the United States and you expect to get elected or reelected, it wouldn't harm your campaign in the slightest if it were leaked out somehow to the press that you actually attended church or synagogue every week. Imagine if that made the paper, nothing. There'd be no response. It'd be like, oh, well, okay, he goes to church. Oh, well, okay, he goes to synagogue every week. Nothing. No big deal. Matter of fact, it might even help your election. Millions of dollars spent every year by communities building new places of worship or refurbishing the existing ones. We build churches all over the place. We build synagogues all over the place. There are mosques being built all over the place. in the United States. But if you were a politician and you were to mention that you had several close encounters with UFOs together with other witnesses, or that you grew up in a house with ghosts or paranormal activity, you can kiss your votes and kiss your career goodbye. You're done. Because you're not talking about this now, you're not talking about God. You wouldn't be talking about God. You'd be referring to something present day that people have witnessed with their own eyes and ears. So obviously you must be a nutcase and nobody should vote for you. We're nuts. We're insane. We don't know where we're at. We've evolved to a point where we just don't know where we're at. These ancient wisdoms that have been supposedly keeping at least the vast majority of people under the control of most of the small groups that have been making use of them, the religions are starting to decay. One more musical, though. It's probably one of the conclusions. This, again, from The Mystery of Edwin Drood, this song, The Writing on the Wall. It's towards the end of the show. It's an affirmation of something. It's an affirmation probably of the only universal truth that you can conclude that defines humanity. And it goes like this.
Life is dear. There can be no victory in defeat. If outnumbered, beat a fast retreat to the nearest shelter and dig in. When you live, then you win. Scratch and claw for every day you're worth. Make them drag you screaming from life. Keep dreaming you'll live forever here on earth. I have read the writing on the wall, and it's clearly spelled out for those who've held out that holding on to life is all. Is it clear? If you hear my voice, then you're alive. What a bloody marvel we survive when you think of every risk we face in our mad human race.
Do yourself a favor, go out and buy that album. It's really worth listening to. It's fun. It's not a downer. Les Miserables, that's a downer. Everybody dies in it. This is just a fun musical. Mystery of Edwin Drood, check it out. I met the composer as a result of being in that show. He came by to try a few rewrites when we were doing it at that theater. Nice guy, Rupert Holmes. So yeah, it is a mad human race. And all we all want to do is stay alive. Some folks argue that the reason that there is so much death and so much war is because we've evolved intellectually in terms of technology and science faster than we've evolved spiritually. And I don't understand that. That almost seems like you're applying... It almost seems like you're applying a football term to a chemistry experiment. Now, evolution, when applied to the human animal and the intellectual properties that cranial capacity has evolved to achieve, is one thing. Using the term evolution in that respect is probably somewhat accurate. But to say that there is an evolution of the spirit, I don't know that it really fits. Because how do you measure that? Where do you find the tracks of that? Where do you find the change? Where do you find the progression? You can certainly measure, track, and examine physically the biological changes in the human animal. You can certainly do that. But how do you determine an advance or a backslide in spiritual change or growth? And is that something that's inherited from one generation to the next? Is there such a thing as an improvement of the species spiritually that's passed on from one generation to the next? I don't know. But I think it's a question worth asking. It's just, you've got to stop when you hear phrases like, well, we're not ready, we were never ready for the atomic bomb, and we're not ready for interstellar flight, or we're not ready for whatever new scientific advance that, of course, can be used to kill people as well as help people. We're not ready for that because we have not spiritually evolved. You put the brakes on and say, what are you talking about, spiritually evolved? It's like, how do you measure it? It's like that scene from, I'm going to make another artistic, going back to art here, another artistic recommendation, a novel called Feet of Clay by Terry Pratchett. There's a scene in it where here's a spoiler alert, you can put your ears in your, fingers in your ears and go la 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 again, because this might spoil it for some people, but Not really. There's a character in it that's a golem. Terry Pratchett's novels, his Discworld novels, are set in a fantasy setting, essentially. But they treat modern themes. He's a master at treating the human aspects of everything using these non-human characters. There's a character in it that's a golem, which is an animated stone creature. For all intents and purposes, they're the robots of the fantasy world. You can have wood golems, you could probably have water golems, depending on the level of magic, but in the Pratchett novels, they're stone. And the priests of the city, all the different religions of the city, want this golem destroyed, and they have a confrontation where they want the golem destroyed because it's an abomination, because it has no soul, and it's walking around as if it's a fully realized individual with rights. And the golem simply turns to them and says, you are right. You're right, I must not have a soul. I'm paraphrasing here. You're right, I must not have a soul. And in order to prove it, to prove that you are correct, you should take me and grind me down to the finest powder you can make me into and sift through all that powder, all the millions of bits of me that you can to the finest degree, to be sure that you do not find a soul. But of course, in order to make it an honest test, one of you is going to have to submit to the same process. So how do you get a measurement of spiritual evolution? And through part of just recording this ramble, I was looking at Times Square. There's a webcam set up at TGI Fridays on 47th Street, looking at Times Square, where all the people are passing by. I'll put a link up in the show notes. And there's all these people living there, working there. I want to end on a positive note here, because there's certainly a lot of brutality that still exists, but I think the amount of people living on Earth that don't participate in it anymore is increasing. I think so long as education and knowledge and awareness of who we are increases, mainly education, so long as knowledge is preserved and so long as people are willing to get past their animal selves and realize that how they feel about a situation won't change it, but what they do about a situation might, then you can have a situation like Manhattan, where I'm looking at every type of human being there is walking past this camera, available to be looked at 24 hours a day. They walk right past each other, and they don't turn to hit. They don't mass up in groups and start fighting each other, for the moment anyway. Proof that it's possible. It's not a perfect city by any means. It's probably a microcosm of the world. There's certainly corruption and violence and injustice rife throughout Manhattan. But for the most part, most people don't want to hurt other people. They just want to get on with their lives. That's all they want to do. And the smartest among them, so long as they're preserved in an environment where they can come up with something new or build on the knowledge that's come down to us from other people that have made the sacrifice to learn, then there's certainly hope that that we can change. Some kind of change can take place. That missing piece may be discovered, or that element within us that makes us the tragic characters we are can be discovered and either tamed or removed, and we may actually get a world where humans don't act like humans anymore, but act like better than human. One last piece of information here, and it goes back to quantum physics, and don't start sweating and don't hit stop, because I'm not going to go into quantum physics, except to mention the particle photon. We've been told, or at least I remember from all my science, that light consists of particle waves called photons. And I never really realized just how much I didn't know about quantum physics until I went to look up photon on Wikipedia. Go ahead and do that, and just try reading the article from start to finish. It's just, I am so out of my depth when I, just from reading that, I have a vague, bare understanding. But if light consists of photons, then They're particles of energy. They're particles that exist with energy. And I saw an astronomy picture of the day from the NASA site that showed galaxy M81. And one of these people walking past the camera in Manhattan were to be taken out of Manhattan and just put in the middle of a field in Pennsylvania without a city nearby, and looked up and saw one of those pinpoints of light that happens to be galaxy M81, then photons entering their eye would be 11.8 million years old. So is progress possible? Is human change possible? I guess I would have to say yes, just very, very slow. Because 5,000 years ago, looking up, that pinpoint of light was just another pinpoint of light, the explanation of which was completely backward, was wrong, was incorrect. Either a hole in the sky that lets in the light from the from heaven, or whatever people from 5,000 years ago thought the stars were. Today, not only is it known that it's a galaxy, but it's known that the light from that galaxy took 11.8 million years to get here. And if you stand in that field and you look up and you see it, you get a photon, you get a particle of energy right in the eye. You're receiving a particle of energy right in your eye. That's 11.8 million years old. And to know that and appreciate that, that's almost better than collecting antiques. You want to talk about antiques? Boy, that's old. And most of what you're looking at up there is just like that. So is it possible that 5,000 years from now, we may actually survive in one form or another? And the next major advance would be that we're not just knowing how long it takes the light to get here, but we're out there among it. Anything's possible, I suppose. The weird paradox is you can take a child or a group of children out in front of their house, set them down, and teach them all about those bad other people and why they should be hated and feared. But you can teach that same child that if you take three sticks, one that's 3 feet long, one that's 4 feet long, and one that's 5 feet long, and connect all their ends, one of the angles in that triangle they make with those three sticks is going to be a perfect 90 degrees, with a perfect 90 degree angle. Everybody can be brought up part fact and part fiction. But there's hope. So, I don't know, Digger. I guess the only thing I'm doing is trying to keep myself aware and ask questions that might help other people to become aware that there's more important things to think about than what's on the TV. I apologize for the rambling nature of this. I did actually have notes written out for it, but I didn't follow them very closely. And it may have taken me a long while to get to no point in particular, but that's nothing new for me. Wrap it up now, and next thing we'll hear is the closing song. After that, I'll say my goodbyes and look forward to more listener feedback. Anybody that's got something to add to this or any other podcast up to now, from 1 through 15 here, there's no limit on when you can comment on any of this stuff. Send in your feedback on episode 4 or episode 2. It doesn't matter. It can be discussed because you can't reach any conclusions on most of the questions that I ask. So let's discuss it some more. Only let's hear from you. Send it to anim5@anim5.com. That's for email. If you go to www.anim5.com and click on the link to get to the International Detective Dragons from Outer Space webpage, you can click on the pink audio button. That will take you to audio, and you can leave me a spoken comment through your microphone. I'll play that. Won't have to read it, just I'll play it here on the show, but let's hear from you folks. Let me know what you think. And now here's a song.
I told you once, I told you twice, I said the only way to find me is right here, one step away. Won't you take a breath? There's nothing left to fear. these fighting words, I'm laying down. They haven't brought me any closer to your ear. The words we spoke have separated hearts that only want to hold each other near. So if you walk around the bend, don't you know?
I think I played that song in particular because it's probably one of the most beautiful pieces of contemporary vocal music that I've heard. That, of course, was Adrina Thorpe, and I will have a link to her album. I bought a copy. She's been played on other podcasts, and that's actually how I first heard that particular song and a couple of others that she's got out. It seemed like a good thing to put a little beauty into number 15, just to counterbalance some of the nastiness. One last bit of art after the Adrina Thorpe. I just got a quote that snapped into my head. It's Tom Stoppard, and I think the play was Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
You live with the truth in the corner of your eye for so long that when it jumps out in front of you, it's like being ambushed by a grotesque.
I guess that's kind of what it's like when you stop and look at the big picture. I know that's a trite phrase. As a matter of fact, I plan on getting a t-shirt that says, I never look at the big picture because I can't stand watching horror movies. All right, I'll shut up now. I thank you extremely much for listening to episode 15. Episode 16 is going to deal with massive multiplayer online role-playing games because I think that's a swell suggestion. It will also, of course, be the episode in which I explain why the podcast is called International Detective Dragons from Outer Space. But until then, thank you for listening. Thank you very much. I hope everything goes well with you. And best of days.